Well, thank you very much for having me. I want to tell the story of the Omanisan land claim. It's a remarkable story. Some of you may know bits of it. It has received a bit of media attention, but no one, as far as I know, has ever written it all up. So it's not a story on the public record. But it is a story with massive intellectual and political implications, and it's also, I think, a profoundly moving story. And it's a story, I think, as you'll hear, which creates a quite interesting challenge for oral history and the archiving and dissemination of oral history, which I hope we'll end up talking about. I want to go back to 1996, a small tourist farm north of Cape Town called Kakukama, about an hour and a half drive of Cape Town, set in very beautiful landscapes of citrus-growing area with many rocks on which there are various bits of Bushman rock art. And a woman called Kate Andrews, who was an ethnomusicologist, South African, brave person, lived through the apartheid regime, very passionate about minority rights, happened to visit this tourist farm, Kakukama, a luxury farm, incredible facilities, swimming pools, massage parlors, all the things you get in luxury places in South Africa. And there at the back was a little exhibit, a living exhibit of Bushmen. You could go and visit the real live Bushmen. And there they were in a grass hut, a family of 10 or 12 of them. A family turned out called Krapa, translates as tracker or creeper in Afrikaans. And there they were in their loincloths and making bows and arrows and making ostrich eggshell necklaces, being Bushmen, wearing Bushmen clothes, living as Bushmen in this grass hut. And you paid your money and you went and visited them. And Kate Andrews was curious about who these people might be. So she went up to them and found out they spoke Afrikaans as well as a language called Khoikhoikhoa, which is the Nama language, the language of the Nama sheep herders who were migrants into the Cape, South Africa, about 2,000 to 3,000 years ago. Quite a powerful sheep herding economy that lived alongside and to some extent penetrated the Bushman world. These people spoke Khoikhoikhoa, the language of the Nama, and they also spoke Afrikaans. So Kate Andrews, speaking to them in Afrikaans, said, "Where are you from?" And they started to tell her that they were from the Hemsbok Kalahari National Park, which is South Africa's second most prestigious park, right at the top of the Northern Cape on the Namibian-Botswana border, a spectacular bit of the Kalahari, famous for its red dunes. That's a little glimpse of it up there. And David Krapa, who seemed to be the leader or the senior member of this family, told Kate that they'd been evicted from this park in the 1970s. Quite brutally evicted. It seemed from their initial story that the eviction was in some way to do with apartheid and the way in which national parks came to be categorized as white lands, therefore people of black and colored people had to clear out, and this was used as a justification, according to the Krapa family, for throwing them out of their ancestral lands and evicting them from the Southern Kalahari. And Kate Andrews, because of her experience with the minority rights issues and engagement with the new ANC government that had been in power just a couple of years, thought there may be a claim that these people could make under the new land claim legislation that Mandela had introduced. And she told a human rights lawyer in Cape Town called Roger Chenels about the Krapa family being on display at Kakukama and the fact that they were evicted from a national park. Roger Chenels went up to see them, got the story in detail, discovered that the father of the of David Krapa, an old man called Rachub Stein, was living still close to the gates of the park in a grass hut on the side of the road. Roger went up and talked to him, and between David's story, David's wife's story, Rachub Stein's story, he put together an account of their dispossession and displacement, and realised that under the land claims legislation that had been introduced, they could indeed claim return of that which had been taken from them. According to the new law that Mandela had brought in, anybody who had been displaced by racist law or implementation of racist law since 1913 could claim that which they had lost. This is not an indigenous or aboriginal rights base claim, this is a claim under the new laws of the South African government. So Roger said to the Craper family, well, you could claim the park. You know, you 12 for 14 people could claim South Africa's second most important national park. So record signer David Craper said, that sounds just fine to us. So Roger said, okay, we'll organise a land claim. This is the first such land claim probably in Africa. There's a small exception with the Namibs, we can talk about later if you're interested about that. This was a straightforward process that looked like the kind of land claim that had been going on in other parts of the world, particularly, of course, in Canada in the previous decade, in the 80s and early 90s. By an amazing piece of luck and happenstance, I happened to meet Roger Channels and Kate Andrews just at the point that when they got this story from David Craper and Raffleson, and they asked me if I would bring the Canadian land claims research methodology to Africa and do a mapping and oral history project which would put together the evidentiary base of the claim. Under the new laws, you had to go before the land claims court with your evidence organized to show irrefutably that you had indeed been displaced by these laws in certain ways at certain times. And of course, the Craper and Rafferstein people had no evidentiary base of their own other than their stories. So the job was to make this invisible story visible, and this is where the Canadian methodology came in. So we had the idea that we'd sit down with people and make maps with them, showing all the places they had lived and known, and date the times at which they had been moved from one place to another. Thinking that we were working with a base of not 12, but probably 20, 25 people. It turned out that some of the family, the Craper family and their extended kin, were living in a township near the gates of the park called Welcome, a grim coloured township which was a place for people classified as coloured to be available for the agricultural frontier that had been going in that area for many years. So there were some people who had been a kakakama who then moved back to be part of this land claim venture. There were the people squatting at the edge of the coloured township and two or three of us sitting there with topographical sheets saying, okay, let's mark up on these sheets everywhere you've hunted, gathered, lived, the grave sites of your elders, and let's work out the dates at which you were moved from one part of this to another. We had very limited success with this mapping. It didn't really work for the Craper-Raffleson group. In fact, Raffleson died early on in the process, which was a great tragedy. He was one of the great repositories of the knowledge about the hunting system they'd used. The people we were working with had been, we discovered, had not been allowed to hunt for many years. Their displacement had been happening long before the 1970s. They'd been pushed off one part of their land, then told they couldn't hunt in another part, and then told they couldn't gather plants in that part. And they'd been, over a long period, in fact, sort of throttled. And their capacity to be themselves terribly, terribly reduced. So we did make some maps, and I've put up one or two examples of the early maps we made, but we realised that this was not going to be the way to proceed, and that we should do something slightly different. We came up with a couple of other techniques. One was to sit with people, and instead of talking about where they've hunted and gathered, we talked to them about where they lived and worked. Nearly all the people we met had been, in fact, proletariat or lumpen proletariat, really, in the farm economy. They'd been the cheapest of labour, sometimes close to slave labour. There'd been migrant workers going from farm to farm. They'd lived destitute on the sides of roads as much as, and on the backs of farms, as much as they lived in the dunes of the Kalahari. So we had this idea that what we'd do is take people through their life story, document with them everywhere they'd ever been, and then discover through that their links to the Kalahari and their links also to their subsistence activities. Now, these people living on the backs of farms and the side of the road were very, very, very poor, no social services of any kind. This is an economy without social welfare, so no medical benefits of any kind. So health was taken care of with plants, so the whole plant knowledge, the whole kind of, as it were, the traditional bushman brilliance at using plants for medicine and food was very much alive because of destitution rather than because of living on Atomic Al-Hari, so people, as they told us their life story, would reveal an extraordinarily extensive use of plants, often going back to places where they lived before. And they also revealed that they had hunted in often in secret and with great difficulty and against great odds, for often for small animals. So there'd been a hunting and gathering economy that had continued wrapping itself around these displaced families. So that was the second technique. So we made some maps, we did these oral histories and timelines, and we converted the timelines into visual representations. There's a couple of examples of those on the wall here. And then the third thing we did was film absolutely everything. And I discovered over the years that film is the most wonderful tool, of course, of oral culture and oral history. So that people love the camera and the camera loves the storyteller. And the digital revolution meant that we could film enormous stretches of storytelling. Then we filmed everything, more about that later. So that was the process that got underway in 1996, 7, and through 98. At the same time, quite early on in this work, by March of 97, we discovered that the Craper family and their extended kin were not the only people in this community, which they said was called the Pomani family. Not a name, in fact, they'd ever used for themselves. We discovered it's a name that had been given them in the 1930s by anthropologists. But they always referred to themselves as the Pomani Salmon, and we discovered that that community didn't just include the Crapers, there were other people. And we discovered these other people partly because they started telling us about them, and partly because, for the purposes of the land claim, Rogers Channels needed to register the community. The legal requirement is to define the community by a list of names. So he set up different registration points. And wherever he set up a registration point, people would come forward and reveal that they were indeed Bushmen, so they were part of the Pomani community. Sometimes we weren't absolutely sure this was true, and sometimes obviously was true, and that was a matter of endless investigation. Early on in this registration process, a woman appeared called Elsie Fileboy, who was very old. In fact, she turned out to be 98 at the point where we met her, and she didn't know that. And she wanted to register, and Roger said to her, "Well, are you a Bushman?" She said, "Not only am I a Bushman, but I speak the Bushman language." Now, the Bushman language of this area, which had always just been referred to as the Pomani language, had been declared extinct in 1974 by a man called Tony Trail, who was a great world authority on Khoisan languages. His work had centered in central Botswana. He had come in 1974 to visit this area, had interviewed many people, and had concluded that the language was dead. So it had been declared extinct by academia, and the apartheid government had declared Bushmen extinct from 1961 onwards. So that kind of the ideological attempt to destroy these people had been part of the apartheid system. The discovery, or the conclusion that they didn't have a language anymore, came from Tony Trail from the University of Botswana. Elsie Fileboy said, and she spoke Afrikaans, and she also spoke Nama, said that actually she spoke three languages, as well as Afrikaans and Nama. She spoke what she called the Otaal, or the Bozmantaal, the old language, or the Bushman language. And she said she was the only person in the world who spoke this language. And this is a source of great grief to her, but it was her piece of evidence that she was indeed, she qualified for the land claim. So we got in touch with Tony Trail, and said, "We think we've found someone who speaks this language, which was thought to be extinct." So Tony came to visit her, and she lived on the borders of Namibia in a grim little place called Rietfontein. And Tony came to her house, and he had a tape that had been made in the 1930s, a recording of people speaking the Pomani language in 1935. It was part of a big research project that went on in the area at the time. And he played this tape to Elsie Fileboy, and Elsie Fileboy said, "But that's my language," and she could translate everything in this tape. It turned out that what had been recorded on this tape wasn't not only her language, but actually the particular dialect of her language that she spoke. So this was undoubtedly exciting news, and Elsie Fileboy was very, very excited that people were interested in her language, and revealed to us that a prophecy had been made. So often is the case in this kind of work, discover somewhere a prophecy was made that all this was going to happen. So she told us that her a nephew of hers had long since made a prophecy that people were going to come from far away and recover her language. So she thought her language is going to be recovered. And the first thing she wanted to do was to record a message in her language to Nelson Mandela. And she recorded a message in this language, and we discovered the name of the language was Ngu. Not only Ngu. Ngu, which in the language means speaking it. But in Ngu, she said, and she translated this for us into Afrikaans, "It's time for us Bushmen to rise up and drive the farmers out of our land." It's a clarion call from a 98-year-old person who could barely walk or see, that was fantastically energized by the thought that her moment in history had come. Now, we were excited, of course, by the speaker of this language. We discovered that Elsie was actually at the center of another part of this community who had not been expelled from the Hemsbok Park, but they had been driven out of their lands by farmers. The land had been completely taken from them. They'd been rendered utterly destitute and then ended up living on the Namibian border in great poverty and immiseration. But there were quite a lot of people. She had a very big extended family, many children, their families. So there was another part of this so-called Nkomani community living to the west of the park on the Namibia border. At the same time, Elsie told us that she remembered that there were other people who spoke the language long ago, living in townships near Uffington, which is the big town in the area of Northern Cape, and also in little townships around Uffington. So we started searching the townships, and we found, after a while, the long story I'm going to cut very short, it's an amazing series of sorties into very terrible and grim and awful places where we found, bit by bit, 22 speakers of the language, living in all kinds of circumstances, from living on the roadside to living in completely indentured farm labourers to being unemployed at the edges of coloured townships. And each of these people had quite a big family, and they all spoke Ngu, and they all spoke complete mutually intelligible dialects of this language, and they came from different parts of Northern Cape. There was one group, the Elsie's group, there was another group that it turned out had also been evicted from the park, but had been evicted in 1936. We discovered three sisters living in the grimmest and poorest place that I've ever seen, called Svartkop. It is a piece of private land. It's a grim little hill, as the name suggests, a little black hill, a rock-covered garbage heap of a place with a great sprawl of people living on it who provide the cheapest of labour to the grape industry. This is on north of the Orange River, an irrigated area. There's a pool of very, very cheap seasonal labour, hundreds and hundreds of people living in appalling conditions, and at the edge of this population of cheap labour, there was these three sisters living, who were all speakers, and who had extended families, and who, because there were three of them, had kept the language very much alive among themselves, but they hadn't passed it on to their children. And we also discovered, to our amazement, that two of these three sisters had in 1936 been exhibited in Johannesburg and Cape Town as part of the 1936 Imperial Exhibition that was organised to try and keep South Africa in the Commonwealth at that time. And somebody, an entrepreneur called Bain, who had been a little bit of a shopkeeper and a bit of a, I don't know, sort of a benevolent presence, it seems, in the Bushman world in the early 30s, had taken a group of 75 Bushmen from the Southern Kalahari to Johannesburg as part of this exhibition. In order to convince the people who ran the 1936 exhibition that he should indeed be able to take this living display there, he had to prove that they were racially pure Bushmen. Interesting venture. And he had to organize in a sort of a systematic investigation of these people that was carried out in 1935 to show what racial classification they belonged in. This is pre-apartheid, apartheidism, if you will. But as a result of this, in fact, one of the most distinguished linguists of the day, Dorothea Blake, some people who did those dreadful anthropometric studies, photographers, came and spent a whole lot of time with 70 to 80 people and produced a report concluding that they were indeed Bushmen. They did an analysis of their skulls and genitals and language and everything, the things that people had to do to prove these racial, to do racial research of the day. As a result of this research, we had found photographs from 1936 of the Cromany Sound community. And this, of course, is where Tony Trail's tape came from. And we showed these photographs to the three sisters, as we did to other people, and they very quickly said, well, that's us. That's our parent there, that's our grandparent there. And so we had this 1936 snapshot of one big part of the community. We knew, so we had it perfectly dated, we had their ages and their family links, everything huge. A wonderfully helpful piece of background research. And we learned from them that when they were taken to be exhibited in Johannesburg, a truck had come and picked them up from under a tree in the dunes of the Southern Kalahari, a tree that sits in a particularly beautiful area of the Hensworth National Park. And that when they came back after being exhibited, apparently were dumped on the side of the road after being travelling for several months, and they walked back as a family, and they came to the local police station, which is sort of just before you get to the gates of the park, and they were told that there was no point in going back, everything had been destroyed. And they did indeed find that while they'd been away, their grass huts, the few things they'd left behind under the trees, had all been burned or taken, and they were told that they could not go back inside the park. It became a park in 1932. So 1936, in effect, this group of families was evicted from the park. Not related to the Crapers, except very, very remotely. Not related to Elsie and her family on the Namibian border, but another whole group of people who also had an eviction story also could therefore claim under the land claim law. So we found that we were launching a claim and doing research and collecting the stories, finding about the languages of not 12 or 14 people, but actually several hundred people. And it's grown now to about 1,000 altogether, in fact. What we were finding was this residue of family groups, bushman groups, that occupied, it seems, the entire area north of the Orange River up to the quite far up into the dunes of the Kalahari, in fact, sort of a complex of hunter-gatherer groups that to some extent can only be hypothesized about. But here they were, hundreds of them, with many, many different kinds of stories, speaking two languages, two Khoisan languages, the Khoipakwak language, the Nama, this Ngu language, and with amazing, amazing accounts of what had happened to them, and tremendous excitement about being part of this land claim. You can imagine what it would be like for people who had been so destitute, rendered so completely marginal and hopeless and helpless, to find that in fact they were now part of some kind of a venture that could lead to them getting back lands that they had lost, parents had lost, their grandparents had lost. Also a venture which meant their stories were being privileged. For the first time they were invited to tell their stories. These are people who had been silenced as extremely as an indigenous population can be silenced. They were ashamed of speaking their language. They told us that they didn't let their children and grandchildren hear the language. They wanted them to speak Afrikaans. They were ashamed of being Bushmen. It was a stigmatized identity, even within the coloured township world. They were abused and despised for being Bushmen, so someone had concealed it, some had sort of defiantly held on to it, but it had been an unhappy and precarious identity. And our research meant that it was no longer something that they could need to be ashamed about. On the contrary, it was something that was being celebrated, and they were being invited to tell us stories, make maps, tell us about their family trees, and all the time to be filmed. We put together all this material bit by bit. The colossal amount of material came flooding in, as you can imagine, and anticipated that it would take quite a few years before this land claim would be realised, though we knew that the evidentiary base for it was strong, especially once we had the Ngu speakers. Before we found the Ngu speakers, in fact, the Parks Department had argued that these were not Bushmen, that there were no Bushmen. There were people who were inventing their identity. I mean, they were sort of a, you know, they were allies of postmodern anthropology in a way. These are not, there's no such thing as these people. There haven't been people, there haven't been Bushmen here for generations and generations. These people are just telling lies in order to get benefits. And, but once we came up with speakers of the language, we had a piece of evidence that was very different in character and something that they yielded to, and especially once we got the story of the 1935-36 evictions, because this was to some extent part of a public record that we had unearthed. So the Parks Department had yielded a bit, and they'd yielded insofar as that they had allowed us to go into the park. Now, Bushmen, when we first started working there, were not allowed to go through the park gates unless they were brought in as park workers. One or two of them had been park workers over the years. And some indeed have been used for teaching the park people how to do tracking and teaching them about animals and stuff. So the disingenuousness often of racism was at work here. But mostly they had not been allowed to go in on the ground. They were drunk and they were awful and they fired arrows at animals and they only would cause upset and embarrassment to tourists. So they hadn't been allowed through the gates. We convinced them that they had to allow us to go through the gates. And then we didn't have to pay to go in. So political victory number one was to go drive in and drive around inside the park. And then political victory number two was to get them to agree that we could get out of our vehicle and walk around. Tourists aren't allowed to do that. So we got past being kind of the, having the status of tourists, having some other kind of status. And we moved freely around inside the park, which meant that people could take us to the places they had known as children. The three sisters took us to the tree where they'd been living when they were taken in 1935 to Johannesburg. And very movingly, they showed us the branch on the tree that was broken off, where they remembered one of the children had been swinging, they made into a swing, and they'd been swinging, and the branch had broken. They dug into the ground and produced the charcoal from the fires that they'd had there. And they also told us that Mr. Bain, the entrepreneur who'd taken them away, had given them lovely china cups, and that these cups had got broken, and the children had got into trouble for breaking these cups, and they dug in the sand under the tree, and they found the shards of the broken cups. An incredible bit of, what do we call it, Langchain's archaeology. They established their place under these trees. They took us to trees about which they told us stories. They took us to a tree where a man called Lucas Box, one of their relatives, who had been passionately in love with a girl that wouldn't have him, had rather dramatically hung himself, but was rescued. So they told this story about love and passion and took us to the branch from which he hung himself on the tree. And these journeys into the park were absolutely amazing. And then they also, of course, took us to the grave sites and places where they gathered plants. And the men who had been evicted in the 70s could take us to the places where they hunted. And trails they'd used to get from one part of the desert to another. And so we were able, once the Park Department allowed us to actually build evidence from on the ground, all of which contributed to the maps and, of course, contributed remarkably to the filming. This went on 98, 99, 97, 98, into the end of 98. We were still thinking this is a huge, complex undertaking, very marginal. We had raised bits of money to do this from Comrade Relief in the UK particularly. And then we got a phone call from Mandela's office, to our amazement. Somebody in Mandela's office phoned the cell, phoned my colleague Nigel Craw, who was one of the main people doing this work, and they said, we want to talk to you about this land claim. And it turned out that someone in Mandela's office, possibly Mandela himself, had heard about the Elsie Fowlboy, the only speaker of the language, story. That got a lot of media coverage from BBC, story on Radio 4, to Australian broadcaster, a lot of South African press. This story, the sexiness of this story had sort of reached everywhere. Mandela's office had heard about it, therefore heard about the land claim, and had seen in our land claim something of a potential iconic importance for the new administration. They wanted to put right the wrongs of racism. Here were the very first victims of racism. and indeed they were the victim not just of Dutch and British colonial expansion into the Cape, but the victims of the Xhosa and other cattle-herding peoples who had come down some hundreds of years before and had also taken the lands of the Bushmen and expropriated whole communities, seen kill off people, absorbed women into their world from the Bushmen communities. So Mandela's office said, we want this land claim to be settled among the first of the claims that's going to be settled, because this is the original victimization of people on grounds of race. So we were fast-tracked to the land claim. We went from being a completely marginal venture to being fast-tracked also to having an incredibly strong negotiating position. Roger Channels, as a lawyer, could ask for almost anything because they wanted this to go through while Mandela was still in power, and that was only going to last another year. So a claim was secured very rapidly for a huge amount of land. They got 45,000 hectares of land outside the park. They got 25,000 hectares of the park, rights to the rest of the park that remained to be negotiated, which gathering rights, rights to have their own tourist lodge in the park, the basis of future economic developments using the park, were enshrined in the settlement, and various institutional governance structures and some money to run those structures. So a very large land claim went through very quickly in March, April 99. Much too fast. No one was ready for this. And whereas in the run-up to the land claim, the key families in this rather fragmented and to some extent reconstituted community had worked very closely together, and there'd been leaders from the different parts of the community who constituted a great alliance, three figures from the different parts who were the three people who negotiated the claim and who shook the hand of Mbeki. Mbeki came up to sign the deal on behalf of Mandela. These three figures were there, they worked together. As soon as the claim went through, everything fragmented. And the leaders became extremely hostile to one another. There was tremendous jealousies and rivalries about the benefits that were going to accrue. The claim included five large farms that had been bought from white farmers to be handed over to the Romani community. On these farms were three beautiful houses. Who was going to have these houses? There were stocked animals. One was a game farm with lots of wild animals. Who was going to have the access to these animals? Who had the right to hunt them or eat them or sell them? Another farm had raised sheep on it. Who had these sheep? There's very big struggles started to happen. And we had the job of providing support for implementation of the claim, and this support included conflict resolution, attempts at leadership training and leadership support, attempts at setting up ecotourism projects, a lot of different packages, while on the ground the community was in a state of turmoil, and some of it very troubling turmoil. I mean, it wasn't, people didn't shout at each other, there were some stabbings, two or three actual murders within the community. People coming from outside, trying to separate people from their resources, people offering to lend them money with the land that they received under the claim as security for the money, thereby hoping they would default and they get the land off them. Such like processes. Dacha, people love smoking marijuana, the Dacha, as they call it, the Dacha trade built up, other drugs coming in, bottle store was opened, alcohol problems because there would be a cash flow. Vehicle disputes. I mean, to have a vehicle, the committee that had to be elected to represent the land claim had a vehicle and money to run the vehicle, and that caused tremendous strife. So it was very, very uncomfortable, very, very uncomfortable indeed. During this period, we continued our work of mapping, filming, collecting storytelling. So we were also collecting stories about the conflict, but then we dedicated ourselves mostly to a small-scale income generation project. In 2008, I went back to the community after a gap, two or three years. Other people were involved in managing the projects, and things had settled down a good deal in that period. And I spent 3 weeks I'm with a cameraman. Twice I brought a cameraman, mostly I filmed it myself, but twice I brought a cameraman to help me. 2008 I brought a cameraman, and we spent 3 weeks talking to everybody involved in this process, in our research, in the land claim itself, in the aftermath of the land claim, about what it had been all like, what it had all been like. So we got the oral history of the oral history, if you will. We got the account in retrospect of 10 years of land claim. And the people told us another kind of story. Sometimes they told us about the hardships, sometimes they told us about their excitement and their sense of triumph, and often they told again, or they recalled what had happened in the course of the work itself. So we had another body of material. Now, that's the story in encapsulated form. I've got an 8-minute piece of film that I'm going to show you, if that's okay, if we have time for that. Which takes you to bits of this bits of this story. And this bit of film was made, in fact, as a fundraiser. We wanted to raise money. We desperately needed to raise money to consolidate all the materials that came from this work. Now, these materials comprise about 115 to 120 hours of film footage, about 1,000 photographs, dozens of maps, posters, from the original sheets we made with people on the ground to processed work where we integrated bits of information. These are examples on the wall. And we wanted to raise money to turn this, we have to raise money, to turn this into an archive and to make this into an archive that is available to the world, with some kind of website presence. And we also aim to make a DVD that the community can use. So we want to realise the value from all this material. And that's the great puzzle of the moment, how to do that. We're underway doing that. But along the way, we thought for a while that what we'd do is make a film and sell it to broadcasters or somewhere where we could raise a chunk of money which we could then use for the archive work. And I made this little trailer to raise money from broadcasters, hoping we'd interest them in the film. Subsequently abandoned the idea of making such a film, decided it was another kind of product that was much more appropriate from all this film material. But I do have this little 8-minute trailer that takes you to the place and the people. So as I say, it was made for fundraising purposes. And I will, it's not subtitled, so I'll shout out bits of translation. You hardly need translation, I don't think. Bits of translation. After the film, it'd be great to have questions and thoughts about it. And this is the opening frame of the film on the screen. These are the these images are from the diorama in the South African Museum in Cape Town, the notorious diorama that was made from Bushman prisoners. I'm going to die.
No,
so you better listen to my story. Listen to what Grandma has to say to you. Complaining about the fact that people have moved on the land to their land.
Well,
see, these are the claws of a lion. The front claw is long.
Thank you.
This is Elsie.
What's my name?
Trying to get the name of the language.
I'm saying I will be a bushman.
and I am is a Bushman. I come from the Bushman people, and I am set down here on the land of the Bushman. The land, the sand, is will be my body. Now I am happy that I can see my old friend, and I think maybe in the future, when all the things will come together, and the God opened the eyes of the blind man, or the people who were blind, they will never see the opportunity for the young children, that all these children, maybe when he will be 10, 12 years, he can speak his mother's old language. And that will be a very big present for my heart.
Stop it there, probably. So that gives you an idea of the, gives you a glimpse of the place and the people and the footage that we have. I mean, there's a sort of door. Each bit of that is a tip of a gigantic iceberg of material. Those of which is, in fact, people just telling stories to camera. But so, we have a bit of time left. Any
thank you very much.
Thoughts?
Thank you. Thank you so much for a very vivid and powerful talk. I would call it a story, but that might be an unintentional pun. Could I start by asking a question about something that you started with, which is the connection between Canada and this story?
Mm.
And in terms of the methodologies, the ethics, and the way of working, what did transport well from the Canadian context to the Kalahari, and what parts didn't, perhaps, of how a land claim we processed? And perhaps to end that question, you talk of an archive or putting these research materials together in a way that can be useful and resonant. Have there been examples of that being done in Canadian land claims that might inform a Kalahari example?
Well, I don't, methodologically speaking, almost nothing transferred from the Canadian experience to here, except the most trivial, perhaps, components. Place names. People make quite a nice place names map, as they're done in the Canadian work, though nothing, with nothing like the authority that, for example, the Inuit could muster when they came to place names map, because these people, of course, are much more distanced from a life on the land than the people I'd worked with in Canada. So that meant you couldn't really take the Canadian methodology and use it here. The idea that there'd be a land claim, the idea that there'd be a research process, of course, a research process that uses maps as an important component, I suppose that was launched by Canadian land claims in the mid-70s. But by the time we were working there, there were many other parts of the world doing a similar kind of thing. So I don't think there was anything Canadian about the process, really, other than the three of the key personnel involved had strong links to Canada. Archiving in Canada is a weakness, I think, in land claims. Of the project, three or four Canadian land claims projects I've worked on, none of them have done an effective job of archiving, least of all the biggest and best one, the Inuit Land Use and Occupancy Study that went on from 1974 to 76, generated and annotated an amazing goldmine of material, especially maps, that was never properly archived, other than being deposited with the museum in Ottawa, and actually put in the National Archive as a physical thing. But in the last year, in fact, that's been pulled out of the archive, and a web-based assembly of that material is being prepared at the moment by a company in Montreal. So it is at last being taken from its sort of frozen archive and being made into a more living archive, and the products are being made visible. But otherwise, the Canadian examples there are lessons to be learned from them about doing it right.
Let me ask you to field questions to see fit. I'm sure there are plenty.
What do you think of recent accusations that groups like Survival International do a lot to perpetuate stereotypes?
There's a way in which activism on behalf of Indigenous people tends to perpetuate stereotypes because they have tended to succeed as a in each particular case, succeed as a community by demonstrating themselves to be deeply indigenous, to look indigenous, to sound indigenous, to have a story of indigeneity. And insofar as survival has supported several of these campaigns, it inevitably has played to that to some extent. On the other hand, if you look at survival's websites or the way they articulate their claims, they're scrupulous about avoiding that kind of stereotyping and argue against it. The trouble is that what plays for the population as well, plays for the media, is this stereotyping, and it's very hard to resist that temptation. We've been subject to this accusation by some academics, and that this entire Pomani land claim is playing to the stereotype, playing off the stereotype. So, and I know how difficult it is to resist the temptation. You know, you send a delegation to Geneva, to that weird indigenous people forum there, and the temptation is to encourage them to turn up wearing headdresses and loincloths and, you know, or sealskin boots or whatever it is that makes them seem wonderfully indigenous, even though those might be things they don't often or indeed never wear. And Petrus Falboy, for example, the man at the end there, who was one of the political leaders of the land claim from early on, would turn up at public events, even in Uppington. I remember going to some event in Uppington where there's a stage and people got on made speeches, and suddenly Petrus turns up in this amazing loincloth and headdress. It looks like it comes from somewhere in the Canadian prairies. I mean, amazing costuming of himself in order to show that he's an indigenous person. And it's touching and awkward, but of course it's quite effective. And it's a place where you get into difficulties always with this work. And survival got into those difficulties for sure at times.
The simple word was just very amazing. How has the Tienese been helped to revive the language?
Our attempt is to revive the language. That's a long story in itself. The discovery of this language was, of course, of momentous importance to the speakers of it. And we brought them together, and as you saw from that bit of film, we had people sending messages back and forth to each other in the language. There was fantastic excitement around the language. And they said they wanted this language passed on to the next generation, and they urged us to have a language recovery program. That's not what they would have called it, but that's what they meant. And interestingly, and perhaps not surprisingly, nearly all the political leadership, including those for whom this wasn't their language and who had no hope ever of speaking this language, also wanted the language to be recovered and passed on. And as Petrus Falboy says at the end there, "In my heart will be happy if my children speak the language." Well, he doesn't speak the language, his mother does, he doesn't, and he has there's no prospect of him speaking the language. So language with 22 speakers, you're going to recover it, and I'm not sure. Politically, it seems to have enormous symbolic importance to do so. So we did set up a language recovery program, and I was lucky enough to find a man called Levi Namasev, who was a Namibian linguist who was teaching at the University of Windhoek, who wanted to do a PhD that was to do with language. And he came as a translator for me to the area, because he speaks Nama. It's actually his first language is Nama. So he could do the translating in Nama and Afrikaans. And then but with a little bit of encouragement, he decided to make his PhD thesis this language, and comparing it to Nama linguistically. He did that. And he went to the University of Toronto and did a PhD on Ngum. And along the way, he developed an orthography for the language. He learned the language well himself, and he set up a teaching program. It turned out to be a completely inspirational teacher, a brilliant inspirational teacher. So he would go and give language lessons using the grandmothers mostly, and taught some of these grandmothers' children and grandchildren the basics of Ngum, the sounding systems, and some simple bits of grammar and a few everyday phrases and sentences, and generated quite a lot of excitement around that. And two or three of those young women got quite good, one particularly got quite quite good. So orthography was created. Also, he recorded what he called the folk tale, the old myths from the grandmothers. He made a collection of those, which he then could disseminate, and he set up this teaching program. He continues to do that in a small way. Meanwhile, Una, the woman who is pretending to be a goshawk in the game on the sands at the end, she now begins every day in the community where they live with a little language teaching game, really, with the preschool children. There was a preschool crash, and she goes every morning and she spends a bit of time with the kids teaching them and getting them to chant words so they get all the sound. The kids love doing the sounding system, and they're miraculously good at it. This is a phenomenally complicated language. It turns out that this language has 125, out of the world possible 150 pieces, has 125 sounds. It is one of the most complex sound systems of any language in the world, as are some of the other quiet sound languages, I'm sure you know. So it's kind of, as Tony Trail said, these are the acrobats of the mouth. I mean, the children enjoy this, you know, they have he gets them making amazing sounds and checks and nasalizations, and that's tonal as well, so they do the tones. And so she does that. So there's a bit of a language learning activity every day, and that's as far as it's gone, which is some distance, but not, it's not a recovery, I don't think.
You said the whole film, you were going to sell it for fundraising, but didn't in the end. Why is that, and what's it used for now?
Well, at the moment it's incredibly difficult to market what you might call immersion documentary to television. There's tremendous resistance to it. And the only way we could have marketed this really would be by either having it heavily narrated by some impressive narrator, or better still, from the point of view of marketing, presented by some celebrity. I mean, one or two footballers, for example, who have a great interest in the Bushman. And we've got an Arsenal forward to present our film. And I can't bear that kind of film. I can't bear it. So I realised the kind of film that I always make is no longer marketable to television for more than, you know, a tiny amount, very marginal channels, perhaps. So we weren't going to get a proper money out of that. We had various goes at it, but we got turned down. Or we were told that if we cut it in a different way, perhaps we could do it. So I realised that we're going to spend an enormous amount of energy, resources, doing something that we're not going to work, we're not going to deliver the money. And I also was very uneasy about it for another reason, and that is, you've got 100 and some hours of material, probably 50 hours of that material is as strong as the material you saw on the screen. I mean, it is absolutely amazing, material, especially around the language stuff. And we have incredible moments on camera. We have the moment, because we started filming everything, we have the moment where people are first ever discover there's a land claim. We have the moment where the three sisters are first ever visited and hear there are other speakers of their language. We have the second visit that's ever made to Elsie Holborn to talk about the language. We have this amazing moments, and they're all over the footage. And people moving back to the Kalahari, and then the disputes are all in the film. So if you've got 100, let's say 50 or 60 hours of material of that quality, if you then commit to making even a feature-length documentary, an 80-minute documentary, with its narrative line, then you have to sacrifice nearly all the footage to your choices about that narrative line, which means you do not do justice to this footage. So it's a way of losing the footage, and I know this from past experience. You go into an edit, with many, many hours of spectacular material, and you come out with one beautiful little film, and you've left scattered on the floor just piles of gems, you know, which then are gone. So in fact, editing film, documentary film, is a way of disappearing most of your material. So conscious of that experience, I thought, I was struggling with the idea that we were going to do it again, with this even more amazing. So I suddenly realised that it could do this in a completely different way. And if we aim for web-based products or double DVD products, we could have 8 hours of material. You could have it as I keep thinking of this expression, a song cycle. So I've broken it down into 15 pieces. Each piece is its own film, edited, lengthy. It doesn't matter what the length is. Some are going to be 7 or 8 minutes, some 15 or 20 minutes. You could watch the whole lot for many, many hours from beginning to end, and it would take you through the whole story from first ever to discovering these people to the 2008 judgment of the whole process. Or you could drop in on the segments, the chapters, if you will. And that could be on the web, I realise. Or it could be on a DVD, and people could go and choose which bit they were interested in, or they could have it all. So that's what we're aiming for. And that's a different kind of film making, but I think it's much more appropriate to perhaps to the kind of communication in the world we're in nowadays, and certainly more appropriate to the kind of footage we have to do justice. So that was a shift in concept that took place about 6 months ago. And since then we've been making the DVD products. There was a question at the back of the room.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask if you're familiar with the work to make a database of traditional Aboriginal Australian knowledge, and whether you're aware of it and the difference.
I'm far less aware than I ought to be. I've seen some bits of it from Central Australia when I was there, and when I met in Paris, the person working on actually an educational package of language recovery and cultural heritage that not dissimilar to this in time. But no, I never heard of it, but I'm sure there's lots there.
Yeah, there seems some parallels between. So yeah. It's just quite curious.
And if you were thinking the things we ought to know about, we'd send them to me.
I was just wondering, couldn't you do both, you know, getting back to the video and more the filming and the distribution of it? Mm. Because I agree entirely that something like a web-based thing where people could actually go through whatever they want or the whole thing is a really good idea. And it's got to be archived and available, I think. But also, if you have something that's smaller that goes on, let's say, television or cinema, it's a limited cinema market for Anthropology, I think. Well, I could be wrong, but anyway. It just seems to me that you would get a different market. Maybe the market that then would move back to the video, but they might not start with such a large thing. Do you know what I mean? It means it would be an easier way to attract people, perhaps.
Yes, I mean, you're right. In a way, in a perfect world, what we'd do is make a broadcastable film of some kind, and at the same time make everything that I've been describing, and then one would inform the other. But particularly a popular product would direct people's attention to this live project. The truth is we just don't have the resources to do this, and that it takes a huge amount of time to make a television film, and we have to pay an editor to do this and cover all the sound edit and online and costs, which are huge, and just to get a film made, we haven't got the resources to do both, or to stretch it out over the amount of time it would require to do both. And so in the end it becomes a question of what is our priority? And our priority is to make the archive and the segmented DVD and web chapters, if that's the right term. It may be that down the road, and maybe not that far down the road, I think we'll have all this segmented stuff done within like 10 months from now, maybe a year from now. So we're underway and it's being done and everything's transcribed and translated, which we'd have had to do for the TV film anyway. It may be that 18 months from now we could say, okay, let's look at how to make this into a TV product. Or it could even be a TV program about the making of this archive, which would take you to this whole story. So a different kind of peg on which to hang it. That would be wonderful. But meanwhile, with limited resources, we're already, you know, $45,000 in debt doing what we're doing. We're desperately raising money. We have people working for nothing. You know, so I can't go to them and say, well, listen, what we do, we're going to take an extra year and we're going to make a TV. But I mean, it's not possible.
Right.
And the reality also is that although, in a way, it's easier, perhaps it would be easier to make a TV program to make this huge thing, it's not easier to raise money. It's easier to raise money for the archive community, web-based product, because it goes to the community, it releases the value of all this scholarship, it releases the value of all this community work back to the community, to the world. That you can get money for much more easily, I believe. If we've got some, we haven't got anything like enough. Very hard to get money for TV broadcasts.
Yeah, I can imagine, actually.
They have been relocated in the 1950s, not 60 years ago. But the problem is that they're just the games, the animals hasn't moved as well where they moved, and they've been relocated where it is very limited to hunt.
Yeah.
But because of this military security that's possessing the land area, how possible do you think, if there's anything like possibility or potentiality that the military area possessing the area move a bit, so the people could access their hunting spots?
Yeah.
Is there anything that is?
Yeah, that's a very good question. In fact, the community, one of the splits in the community is over this very question. There's one sector of the community, in fact, it's the Craper family, the original claimants, who are saying that the only way forward is to get back onto the original territories and to set up a hunter-gatherer. Set up a hunter-gatherer world would be fanciful, even by there, on their account, but to have a hunter-gatherer component of their lives which is accessible to them, so they could spend part of the year there, or they could live within walking distance of there. And that's what they're pushing for. And they have negotiated the right to hunt in the park, and they have negotiated the right to gather plants, and they have built what they call an elder's retreat right in the middle of that, of a hunting area, where people can go and be spiritually regenerated and use the language in the context where it belongs. So that is what's happening on one side of the community. Another side of the community is not so interested in that, other than that they're in favour of it in principle, but they're much more interested in setting up sheep farms and having what you might call a modern, sort of quasi-modern economy that they will do well out of in cash terms. And that split is bedevils the community, in fact. But there is one group, a very interesting group, that is pushing very much for a reintegration of language with environment, I suppose, is the way to put it. Is that what you mean?
Particularly the military security when it's possessing the area.
Yeah.
And you know, it wouldn't be problem for United States to move a little bit further, perhaps.
Yeah.
So people could come to access the hunting game.
Mm-hmm.
Hunting spots.
In Northwest Greenland,
Is there any possible something like that could be done?
Could be done in Northwest Greenland?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what can be done in Northwest Greenland. I can only make an analogy with what the argument is in Kalahari. And it's the kind of thing that's been done in Canada. There have been big concessions made to enable people to have use of their ancestral land.
Are you saying, in response to that last question, that within one generation these people have lost the desire to be hunter-gatherers and can see that there are other ways?
I wouldn't say it's one generation, I'd say 2 to 3 generations. In that probably the family that are leading the charge to be sheep farmers have been working as sheep herders on farms for 2-4 generations,
yes,
and perhaps some of the 3 generations. So they're quite far removed from a life which has as its land base hunter-gatherer territory, though, as I was saying earlier, they have done lots of hunting and gathering around their lives as sheep herders. It's not a dichotomized reality, but it is the dominant economic reality for 2 generations or more has been the farm. Even those farm labourers.
I think I'm going to have to ask people to talk to Hugh afterwards briefly. Have you got a moment to come and talk afterwards, yeah? I don't know if I have to leave, get back to work. Thank you once again for a very, very significant